and Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and I'm going to have Andrew Saul tonight. We're going to be talking about the book he co-authored with Abram Hoffer, The Vitamin Cure for Alcoholism. First, tell us a little bit about you before we get started.
Well, I've been had the pleasure of working with Dr. Abram Hoffer for a number of years, and we have collaborated on two books, one you've mentioned, the alcoholism book, The Vitamin Cure for Alcoholism and Other Addictions. And the other major book was Orthomolecular Medicine for Everyone. Dr. Hoffer published that about 20 years ago as Orthomolecular Medicine for Physicians, and we updated and revised it. In addition to that, I've been working in university teaching for about 10 years and also as an author and consultant for another 25. So this is about my 35th year in natural health education. My background is in teaching. I'm not a physician, but I have had the pleasure of confirming with my family what Dr. Hoffer's been saying for a good long time, in fact, from the early 1950s, that high doses of vitamins prevent illness, high doses of vitamins cure illness, and high doses of vitamins are safe. These are the most important things I think I could offer to your listeners. There is an assumption that vitamin therapy is somehow dangerous. The fact is, it's not. The American Association of Poison Control Centers, which reviews these things every single year, finds that not one single person in the United States of America has died from a vitamin supplement.
So you are a PhD, though, and you do have another fabulous book that we talked about a year or so ago, Fire Your Doctor. An excellent book. I just want to make sure it's...
You're right. I have a PhD, also a master's, and the book you mentioned, Fire Your Doctor, was forwarded by Dr. Hoffer, himself a physician, so that's kind of fun. And the other book that I'm known for is called Doctor Yourself. Doctor Yourself, I'm happy to say, is in its eighth printing now. And I've been featured in a wonderful documentary movie by some young folks from Australia. The movie is called Food Matters. If people go to my website, DrYourself.com, they, of course, can learn more about me and more about my books and also see clips from this movie, which I think are very informative and a lot of fun.
I have to say, I have read every word of that Fire Your Doctor book and your treat what Dr. Yourself and The Vitamin Cure, and they're excellent. They're easy to read, and they're good for people to use at home. You can understand them. So, we're going to be talking about orthomolecular medicine. What is that, please?
Orthomolecular medicine, simply put, is personalized high-dose nutrition therapy. It's taking the right amount of nutrients to actually get the job done. A couple of glasses of orange juice aren't going to do it. With vitamin C, we're talking at sometimes tens of thousands of milligrams of vitamin C a day. Same with niacin. The USRDA is about 15 milligrams a day or so, and Dr. Hoffer would commonly prescribe 3,000 milligrams a day. So it's about dose.
Okay, we're going to be talking about addiction. Everybody says, well, I won't say everybody, because there are a few of us who know differently, that addiction is not curable. Is addiction curable?
Yes, it is. And the best evidence for this is probably the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill W. Bill W. was a patient of, are you ready for this? Dr. Abram Hoffer, my wonderful co-author for The Vitamin Cure for Alcoholism. Bill W. was trying to get people to work the steps of AA, and these steps are well known, and they involve all kinds of good, solid measures, none of which are really nutritional, and they are effective. I have taught certified alcoholism counseling courses in New York State, and I have an understanding here of just how difficult it is to break addiction. I've taught in two state prisons, no, not as an inmate, and we have worked with folks who have tried the hard way to get over alcoholism and other addictions. Believe it or not, the inmates, almost to a man or a woman, I taught at a men's and a woman's penitentiary, would say that as difficult as it was to get off alcohol, as difficult as it was to get off cocaine, getting off tobacco was even harder. So we know, we don't think, but we know that vitamin therapy does make it easier to break these addictions. Here's two examples. There was a study done in Drug and Alcohol Dependence, a peer-reviewed journal, that showed that whenever people want a cigarette, if they spray some vitamin C in the back of their mouth and then have the cigarette, eventually they won't want the cigarette. Apparently, vitamin C literally helps to break a nicotine addiction. A second example, I think, is just as spectacular. Back in the late 1970s, doctors Ewan Cameron of the Vale of Leven Hospital and in Scotland and colleagues, and one colleague, by the way, included Linus Pauling, showed that patients that were seriously ill with cancer, terminally ill, who had intravenous vitamin C, not only lived longer, an average of five times longer than those who did not get the vitamin C, but also were able to come off strong narcotic pain medicine, including heroin, without withdrawal symptoms. Now, this goes right in the face of what we've been told about addictions. But the funny thing is, in trying to treat addictions, we've sort of done everything but use high-dose vitamins. Literally now, for 30 years, I've been saying what Dr. Roger Williams, a wonderful biochemist and a professor at the University of Texas and discoverer of the B vitamin pantothenic acid, Dr. Williams said before I was born, when in doubt, use nutrition first. We use nutrition last. This has got to change.
So it's hard to, I don't think we can get vitamin C intravenously like we used to could. So can we dose high dosages every day with an oral supplement to get that effect?
The answer is yes and no. You can often obtain intravenous vitamin C if you have a physician that is willing to work with you and advocate for you and say, all right, let's try this, and especially in a hospital situation, to say, this is a value to the patient, we're going to do it, nobody dies from this, it can't hurt, let's try it. Some doctors will play ball. There are orthomolecular physicians around the United States. The best way to find them is with an internet search or to ask other people who've been to them, and there are some directories. One such directory, actually a directory of directories, is available at orthomolecular.org. Orthomolecular.org is a website that has newsletters from the Orthomolecular Medicine News Service. And one of these actually lists out a whole bunch of directories that people can use to find a doctor. But your point is, can you do this orally? And the answer is you sort of can. People that are very, very ill sometimes find it difficult to take vitamin C orally in high doses because if their stomach's upset easily, or if they've been on a lot of medication, or if they're nauseous, or if they're just plain not hungry, taking a lot of tablets can be kind of a daunting experience. Linus Pauling suggested using vitamin C powder instead because you don't get all the excipients and tableting ingredients if you take pure powder. You can take the pure powder with juice and buffer it perhaps with a little calcium supplement. Or you can take vitamin C with tablets, but you just have to take a lot. Either way, the best way to take oral doses of vitamin C, whether you use powder or tablets, is to divide the dose. This is a very important concept. You want to take as much C as you can, but you want to take it as often as you can. So if someone were very, very ill, and I was that person once, I had viral pneumonia, and I took 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C every 6 minutes. That's a lot of vitamin C. I remember distinctly I was playing a game of Scrabble with my wife. I lined up the tablets, I had my big pitcher of water, and I had a clock. And every 6 minutes I took 2,000 milligrams of C. Bear in mind the RDA of vitamin C is 100 milligrams a day. In 3 hours, my cough stopped, and my temperature came down 3 degrees. Now, this is one example of why you have to take high doses and you have to divide the dose. If a person's very sick, the amount of vitamins they can hold is very high. But if you take all of that at once, your body's going to urinate a lot of that out, not to mention that it might make you nauseous. So you have to take enough C to be symptom-free, whatever that amount might be, but you have to divide the dose. The same is true with B-complex vitamins, which are also water-soluble. Dividing the dose means better absorption and better success.
I just have to add, too, that diarrhea is a part of vitamin C if you take too much, so spread it out. I just got to say that. So why does AA not include nutrition? Why do they refuse to do that?
Well, there's two answers to that. The harsh answer is that because the medical profession kind of got a hold of it, even during Bill W.'s time, the medical profession, many feel, has been always reluctant to use high-dose vitamin therapy because they've been taught to use drugs instead. And the very idea that there can be a cure in a vitamin pretty much flies in the face of most physicians' education. Doctors' education is heavily funded by the pharmaceutical industry. Not only their education in medical school, but also their clinical experience, their research experience, and their continuing education seminars. This is well known. The more general reason why AA does not use vitamins is because they feel it's outside of their purview, that this is between a person and their doctor. This is a medical question, not a behavioral, motivational question. And AA prefers to not recommend a therapy that they feel should be between patient and doctor. Personally, since their founder sent out not one but two mailings at his own expense to AA's membership saying, take the niacin, take 3,000 milligrams of niacin. Since AA's own father wanted AA members to take vitamins, I think we need to look at this anew. AA helps a lot of people. It would help a lot more if it encouraged the use of high-dose nutrients, especially niacin. Bill W. was adamant about this. He looked into this in the beginning. He tried niacin for his own severe depression. Dr. Hoffer actually did not treat him for being an alcoholic, but rather being a depressed, recovering alcoholic. So on 3,000 milligrams of niacin, vitamin B3 a day, that's 1,000 milligrams in three different doses per day, Bill W.'s depression went away in about a week. He was very impressed. So Bill W. said to 30 of his friends, listen, this looks good, give it a try. So 30 of Bill W.'s friends tried 3,000 milligrams of niacin a day, as Dr. Hoffer recommended. A third of them were completely better in about a week to 10 days. Another third were completely better in about a month. And another third reported that it didn't help them. Two out of three ain't bad. And Bill W. was impressed. And since he was, and since he himself had suffered so much and personally experienced this, I think AA should reopen the book on it.
I do too. So let's talk about niacin for a minute. There are three different forms of niacin. And
at
let's
least.
Talk about the flush. So is there one preference over the other? And some people say, oh, I have a terrible reaction. Is it really a reaction? Is it dangerous? Doesn't it go away after a period of time? What does that flush really mean to people?
Well, let's start with the second part. Is the flush dangerous? The answer is no. It's a vasodilation, and it is not a serious matter at all. I have to admit, for many people, having a niacin flush is a bit of a jolt, especially if you don't expect it. So as Dr. William Parsons, Jr. said, and he was one of the experts in using niacin for patients with high cholesterol, Dr. Parsons said, the physician has to understand niacin in order to use it. Well, to understand it, you have to start with the fact that plain old regular niacin used to be called nicotinic acid. It is biochemically unrelated to nicotine. But nicotinic acid does cause a flush. And the flush varies from person to person, who they are, the stress they're under, the amount they take, what they had for dinner, how much they take, and other factors, even if their food was hot or cold. So if you were taking niacin for the first time on an empty stomach with a cup of hot cocoa, you're going to have a flush. And the more you take, the more flush you'll have. But Dr. Hoffer emphasized not only is the flush harmless, but it will go away. If you keep taking niacin in high doses regularly, in about 2 weeks, maybe three, people generally stop having flushes. There are some folks that just can't abide that. They don't like the flush. That's all there is to it. As for me, I kind of like it. I live in upstate New York, just across the lake from Canada. And around here, being warm is kind of nice. Winter for us just ended about a week and a half ago. So the niacin flush for me is an asset. But if you can't stand the flush, you can take two other forms of niacin. One is niacinamide. And niacinamide does not cause a flush except in extremely unusual cases. I would say not more than 1 in 1,000 patients. Niacinamide is perfectly good in terms of relieving depression, but it has no effect at all on blood lipids. This is important. Niacinamide will not lower cholesterol, or more correctly, raise HDL and lower triglycerides. The president of the American College of Cardiology has said that niacin is it. Nothing else comes close. Niacin is the cheapest and safest and most effective way to raise HDL and lower triglycerides. There's just no question about that. So niacinamide won't do it. And now you're thinking, oh, great, I either have to have the flush or I can't take the form that works. No, there's a third form. The third form is inositol hexaniacinate. Sorry about the name. Inositol hexaniacinate. It's also known as inositol hexanicotinate. This is a form of niacin that does not cause a flush. It's slightly more expensive, but still widely available. You can get it even at big box discount stores. It doesn't work quite as well as regular niacin, but it does work, and it will lower the blood lipids. Now, you mentioned three forms. These are the three. There are actually a couple of other forms, but they are relatively rare, and most people will not bump into them, with the possible exception of chromium polynicotinate. And that's actually a chromium supplement bound with niacin, and there's not a lot of niacin in it. People ask very often, well, what about foods? Can I just eat more foods that are high in niacin? The answer is, yes, you could, and go ahead and do it. But the amount of niacin you could get even in the most excellent diet would not even come close to 100 milligrams a day, and a therapeutic dose is around 3,000. So supplements are necessary if you want to get the job done.
I need to do a disclaimer here because I want people to understand that you're not a medical doctor and we're not trying to treat or diagnose. We're providing information only. I just want to cover us on that.
Not only that, I have no financial connection with any health products company whatsoever. So I have no vested interest in the vitamin sales business. And we always make this perfectly clear that what we're talking about is what Dr. Abram Hoffer found. We're reporting what this physician learned in 55 years of high-dose vitamin therapy practice.
Now, I don't want to get off on this line of what I'm about to say, but I do want to bring it up because it's important, I think. Can niacin thin your blood to people who have to be careful about thinning blood with niacin?
In other words, does it increase coagulation time or clotting time?
Correct.
Does it increase prothrombin time? No, that would be vitamin E as in Edward.
Okay.
Vitamin E as in Edward will slightly lengthen clotting time. This is a good thing for people that are on Coumadin, which is a brand name of warfarin. The whole idea for folks that have various thrombosis is that if they take a blood thinner, so-called, it will help keep them from having blood clots. Vitamin E does the same thing, but this is a different vitamin. This is a different chemistry.
Vitamin B, niacin does not affect clotting at all?
To my knowledge, niacin does not significantly affect the clotting time. If someone finds out that it does, I'd like them to please mail me the paper and I will read it.
Well, I don't have a paper, but it did affect mine.
Okay, in that case, we'll start right
there. That's why I'm asking that question.
Yeah, it's a perfectly good question. If you have experience where taking niacin did cause that issue, then this underscores what Dr. Hoffer and I have been saying in our books, which is you need to work with your physician when you're using orthomolecular medicine. This isn't something that we want folks to just go off on and try. This is something we want folks to take to their doctor and try. For instance, when people take high doses of niacin, they can expect, in addition to the flush, they can expect the likelihood of liver function test changes over time. If they take niacin for many months in high quantity, there is a change in liver function tests. Dr. Parsons points out that these changes indicate an active liver, not liver pathology, but they need to be interpreted right. Therefore, a person that's being monitored when they take niacin is going to have a chance to talk this over with their doctor. I urge them to read Dr. Hoffer's books on niacin, and there are several, and also Dr. Parsons' excellent book, that's William B. Parsons, Jr., on how to use niacin for heart disease. Like any other therapeutic approach, this requires intelligence, trial and error, and working with your doctor.
So if one supplements with high doses of niacin, I know the B vitamins work together hand in hand. Should they also supplement with a B complex? And if
Yes, that's a very good point.
How do they know?
Not only is it a good idea to take niacin, it's a good idea to take the rest of the team of B vitamins. In the same way that a hockey team or a baseball team is more than just one or two players, the nutrition of the body involves more than just one or two nutrients. We're highlighting niacin because Dr. Hoffer's special expertise was there. But in the Vitamin Cure for Alcoholism book, Dr. Hoffer and I talk about a number of other nutrients, including one, a plain old good diet that has no junk food, very little sugar, and lots of fresh, unprocessed whole foods. That's the best supplement of all. And I want to emphasize that. This is not about how many vitamin pills can you take. This is about being healthy. The problem is a lot of people aren't healthy, and if you try to get them to change their diet, well, that doesn't always work. It's difficult to get a person to alter their diet and make them into a health nut. So supplements are an easy way to get high doses in with relatively little lifestyle change. But make no mistake about it, a healthy, unprocessed whole foods diet, low in sugar with no junk food, is the number one vitamin approach. And that will give you enormous amounts of quality nutrition, especially trace minerals, from your foods, and that's the way it should be. Eating organic food is helpful. Growing from your own garden is helpful. Minimal processing is helpful. Raw vegetable juicing is a good way to get nutrients. All of these things are useful. In addition to this, you want to avoid negative foods. Things like alcohol and sugar take nutrients out of you. So you want to avoid the minus foods as well as eating the plus foods.
So how do they know how much of the other vitamin B vitamins they need to take? I mean, I know, do you take like a B150 or a B100? Because I know that you can get too much of six if you start, you know, when you start taking them individually, you can get in trouble. So is a complex the way to do it?
Well, it basically
makes
it
sense.
Is. A B complex preparation, first of all, is convenient. Take one tablet rather than a whole bunch. Secondly, it's economical, same reason. And the third reason is there's inherent safety taking the whole team. I'd like to address B6 for a minute since you mentioned it. B6 is pyridoxine. The RDA for B6 is around 2 milligrams a day, a little less. It has been shown that people who take extremely large amounts of B6, usually several thousand milligrams a day of B6 alone, can develop some temporary neurological side effects. So that's not recommended. A very small number of people have had problems with B6 at 500 milligrams or even a little bit less. But virtually no one has trouble with B6 around 100 or 200 or 300 milligrams a day. And bear in mind, that's still about 100, 150 times the RDA. B6 is much safer if you take it with the other vitamins. And as you pointed out, that's really the take-home lesson here. So the B-complex preparation, along with the other nutrients, is your best way to take B6. You're going to need more niacin, though. Remember I said the RDA for B6 is a couple of milligrams a day? And for thiamine, it's around a milligram, that's B1. And basically, you'll find that the requirement for the B vitamins is a fairly low number, whereas niacin is a surprisingly large number. It's about 10 times higher than most of the other B vitamins. So this shows that we need relatively more niacin. So is it good to take all of them? Yes. Is it good to take extra niacin? Yes. And while we're at it, extra vitamin C is very important. And vitamin C doses, according to Linus Pauling, have to be in thousands of milligrams to really do any good. Again, the RDA is only around 90. So we have to think big. It is safe to do that. People think, vitamins are like drugs. Vitamins are drugs. Drugs are dangerous. Vitamins are dangerous. It's not true. Vitamins are nutrients. Nutrients are not drugs. The rules are different. You can do anything wrong. Can you overdose on vitamins? Mm-hmm. Is it easy? No. Can some people do it? Sure. If you take too much niacin, you'll have nausea. Don't do that. If you take too much vitamin C, you'll have watery explosive diarrhea. Don't do that. You take enough to feel better and get the job done, not so much that causes a symptom. Dr. Richard Passwater has a very nice, simple, practical way of determining your vitamin dosage for each person individually without using tests. Now, you can have tests done if you want, but the body changes every hour, so the tests you had done at 6 in the morning or 8 in the morning are not going to be valid by 6 or 8 at night. Nevertheless, you can have blood levels taken if you really want to do that. For instance, if you want to monitor your vitamin D, D as in Doug, there is a blood test that your doctor can have done, and I would recommend it. Not to go too far off on the side here, but I went to my doctor and said, listen, I've been taking a lot of vitamin D. Oh, my, for a couple of years now, I've been taking a couple of thousand units of D a day. And that's quite a lot more than the RDA. It's, you know, about 8 or 9 times the RDA. So the doctor tested me for vitamin D, and guess what? I was low.
I was about to say, I take 50,000 a week.
There you go. And now I take a lot more. So there's a case where the blood test told me, take more vitamins. But back to your question, and my early abandoned answer, which is talking about Dr. Richard Passwater. He wrote a wonderful book many years ago called Super Nutrition. It was one of the first health books I ever read back in the 70s. And Super Nutrition has a nice passage where it tells you how to just rough and ready determine your vitamin dosage. Dr. Passwater says, start taking a moderate level of a nutrient and gradually increase it. And notice if you feel any better. And he says, if you feel a little better, take a little more. And if you feel a little better, take a little more. And then if you take a little more and you don't feel any better, stop. Go back to the level where you had an improvement. So if you're taking a little more and feel better, take more and feel better, take more, feel better. At the point where you don't notice an improvement, level off. That's good advice.
Yeah. Okay. Please discuss the research of David Hawkins, because I know that he and Abram worked together a lot.
Mm-hmm. Dr. David Hawkins, a psychiatrist, as was Dr. Hoffer, ran the North Nassau Mental Health Center in Long Island. Now, Dr. Hawkins now is fairly elderly. He lives out in Arizona. I had the pleasure of inducting him into the Orthomolecular Medicine Hall of Fame a while back. also Dr. Hoffer as well. Dr. Hawkins used high doses of nutrients to treat addicts and people with psychiatric problems very successfully. In fact, Hawkins co-edited, along with Linus Pauling, a textbook called Orthomolecular Psychiatry. And this came back out in the early 1980s. This is a huge book. Everything you always wanted to know about using vitamins as therapy has been known literally for 30 years. So it's not new. It's just perhaps new to the person that's hearing me say this. But orthomolecular or megavitamin therapy has been used by physicians such as Dr. Hawkins for over 30 years. Hawkins had tremendous success using Dr. Hoffer's protocol.
What is the HOD diagnostic test?
The HOD test, or the HOD test, was developed by Dr. Hoffer and Humphrey Osmond. That's why it's called HOD. That's for Hoffer-Osmond Diagnostic Test. It's a large number of questions, basically on flashcards, and a patient is asked this series of questions, and from that, with a key, they can determine whether or not they're schizophrenic and how schizophrenic they are. So it's a non-invasive way of kind of getting an eyeball as to whether or not a person is moderately or severely schizophrenic.
Okay. So what is, and I've got about 20 more questions here, so.
Bring them on.
Let you know that. What is the role of hypoglycemia in an addict?
Oh, my gosh. That is such a good question. If Dr. Hoffer were here, he would say that may be the most important factor. I had a friend who was also working in prisons, and he was a counselor, and he said to me that at least half of inmates in jail have low blood sugar. And at the time, that just kind of went by me because I was a young man, but I've given that a lot of thought, especially after working with Dr. Hoffer and learning from him. Low blood sugar is an enormous problem. There is so much mental reaction to a blood sugar crash. Mood is so dependent on blood sugar that it's hard to even appreciate this until you've been there. Most normal people are able to tolerate times of not eating and times of eating too much, even times of eating too much sugar. For instance, if you go to a child's birthday party, you'll see that most of the kids can shovel in the cake and the cookies and the ice cream and the candy, and most of them will handle it fairly well, and they might get a little bit rambunctious, but, you know, they're kids, and it calms down after a while. So that's where they get a little bit of a rush of blood sugar and then a bit of a crash. The more sugar you take in, the more insulin your body kicks out. It grabs the sugar and stores it away as fat. This is how your body keeps you from having high blood sugar. But back to that party. I'll bet you that at that party, there's going to be one or more children that don't handle that influx of sugar very well. And they're the ones that are going to be particularly hyper. And when they have the insulin kick out, they're the ones that are going to crash particularly low and be particularly troublesome and particularly moody. Now, as you mentioned, I'm not a physician. My background is in education. I've taught every grade there is, from first grade to postdoctoral, literally every grade. And I remember when I was teaching in the young grades, I actually saw this in grade school and junior high. I would note which kids were the wackiest, the ones that were the biggest behavioral problems in class. And some of them, I noticed, were coming to me, especially in junior high, after lunch. Well, I had lunch duty a few times, and I remember just kind of watching what they put on their plate when they went through the line. This one kid, who was just nothing but trouble, I saw what he had for lunch one day. He had, and this will sound ridiculous, but this is what he had four bright pink, artificially colored strawberry ice cream sundae sandwiches. That was his lunch.
Well, I know.
Now, that isn't good for anybody, but for some kids, it really sets them off. We know this. It just makes sense. Now, let's take a look at what Dr. Hoffer thinks, how this ties into addiction. Dr. Hoffer was very certain that sugar was the first addiction, that having sugar and too much of it is how the addictions really root out. Once we become kind of hooked on sweet stuff, it becomes easy to become hooked on other stuff. Now, I recognize that that's a bit of a leap, but his experience, and for that matter mine, have tended to confirm this. Dr. Hoffer said often that healthy people don't become addicted. In order to become addicted, there has to be something missing, a weakness, a nutritional, physiological weakness. Here's an example of how you can test this. I saw a lady many years ago. She was brought in to see me by her husband. Her husband was a surgeon. Now, this woman had been to just about every alcoholism facility you can think of, including the very expensive, big-name treatment facilities that are so often in the news. None of them can help her. She was, and no mistake, a serious alcoholic. Nice lady, but she just drank a lot and nothing could stop her. So her husband and she asked me, is there anything that might help nutritionally? And I said, well, I don't know, but it's certainly worth a try. You've tried everything else. Why not try this approach that Dr. Hoffer and Dr. Roger Williams and Dr. Hawkins are using, because they're reporting good success. And what's that? They said, and I said, well, lots of vitamin C, lots of B-complex vitamins, extra niacin, and some L-glutamine. L-glutamine is an amino acid. Dr. Roger Williams found that alcoholics that take around 1,500 to 3,000 milligrams of L-glutamine a day seem to be able to resist drinking better. So the lady did all that. And it wasn't that much long later, I would say it was a month or two, I got a call from her, and she said she was not drinking anymore and things were great. And I was elated. It was just wonderful. And then a few months later, I got a card from her. She'd gone back to college in her 40s. And she'd send me a Christmas card every year saying she was doing fine and she was coming along well with her studies and she wasn't drinking. And then one year I got a card from her and it said, you know, I've even found I can have a drink or two now and again. And I thought, oh my gosh. One of the tenets of alcoholism education and treatment is that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Now, what happened with her was that she was now taking a drink or two, and she would stop. If she wanted a drink or two, she could have that and no more. And she didn't crave it, but she also didn't have to fight it. What does that mean? I think it means she was cured. I think it means she wasn't an alcoholic anymore because she was drinking like a normal person. A normal person can have a glass of wine, maybe two, without going and ending up in the gutter with a brown paper bag. I'm exaggerating this, but I think you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
So this means, an addiction can be cured, not just assisted, but actually cured.
I want to ask you about some other research going on. There's some people doing some research that is saying that addicts, and they have found that addicts are heavy metal toxicity, specifically copper and aluminum. And they've been using metal detoxing to treat addiction, of course, along with nutrition. And one of my questions is, if you're going to do that metal detoxing, if that's true what they're saying, it makes sense because copper is so conductive. I can imagine it causing a lot of excessive firing going on in the brain and the gut. Would you do the metal detoxing separately or together while you're using the vitamin therapy and the amino acid therapy?
Well, I don't have a lot of knowledge or experience with that particular therapy. But I would say it would be a good idea to do everything you possibly can to deal with this problem, and I'm for doing the two together. If there's a contraindication, that would be a reason to say, no, Dr. Saul, you're wrong on this one. But I think that in this particular case, the two together would probably be more effective than either one alone.
Okay. I also want to make a comment about sugar, just for the listening audience. I had an experience with my daughter last night. We went out and we're working on our farm this weekend, and we went to Chick-fil-A, which we don't normally do, but we did. And she got a packet of ketchup. And after she ate that packet of ketchup, which, of course, is high in high fructose corn syrup, she was acting like she was drunk.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. I said, Jessica, you are acting like you're drunk. You know how drunks get tipsy and loud and giggly? She was acting just like that after eating one package of ketchup. So I just want to say it matters. You know, I think that refined sugar and high fructose corn syrup make a difference, kinds of sugar.
Yes,
do you have a
and
comment on
everybody
that?
Is different, because many people listening are thinking, wow, you know, that's pretty hard to imagine. But it isn't hard to imagine if you see it. It isn't hard to imagine if it's you. And we have to keep in mind that the bottom line here is we have to do what works. The thing to do to test this out, and this is a completely inexpensive and safe and utterly elementary thing to do, is just don't do it anymore. Keep that person away from sugar and see if they do better. I guarantee that if you have a problem and you have sugar, it'll get worse. I've never seen a problem that sugar makes better. I've seen a lot of problems that sugar makes worse. A corollary to this is artificial colors for children. Some people say, oh, you know, artificial colors and artificial flavors, those chemicals have been in food for decades, and most people handle them fine, and there's really not that much evidence. And I disagree with those statements, but that's what a lot of people would say. And I would say, well, what's the benefit to the child of having artificial colors? What's the benefit of having junk food? Why don't we simply try not having those for a while? It's not going to hurt the kid to keep them away from artificial colors. And let's just test it out. Let's do a therapeutic trial. Let's see what happens if little Jimmy or little Janie are not given junk food, and let's see if they do better. What's wrong with trying that? You'd be surprised how many people won't do it. Dr. Hoffer, when he saw children, this was wonderful, he would tell the children, he'd lean over to them, and he'd say, no junk. And he told me, they all know what that means. He would say to them, no junk, all right? And they would nod. And then he'd say, look, if you do have to have junk food, you can only have it on Saturday. And the children would listen very attentively to that, and the parents also. And he'd say, you can have all the junk food you want on Saturday. It would be better if you didn't, but if you want junk food, only Saturday. Is that a deal? And they'd say yes. So the child would be off junk food all week. Things would go fine at home, at school. And then the kid would garbage up on Saturday and be sick as a dog on Sunday. And they learned not to eat junk food that way. Now, that sounds a little bit harsh, but it can't be more harsh than loading them up on Ritalin and other drugs that now millions and millions and millions of American kids are on. Personally, I think this approach is much better than any pharmaceutical one. Don't underestimate the simple solution. It's just extraordinary how much you can do by avoiding sugar, avoiding junk, and taking some vitamins. And if a person says, well, I don't believe in this, they're not being scientific. This is not about a belief in vitamins. This is about the bottom line. Does it help patients? How do we know it helps patients? We can check the medical research. If you do, you'll find that there's a good, strong track record of vitamin therapy for these illnesses. But you have to know where to look. If you want to find these papers, not all of them are indexed on Medline or PubMed by the National Library of Medicine, the major holder of health information on the planet. If you search Medline or PubMed, you will not find any papers at all from 43 years of the Journal of Orthomolecular Medicine. It's been shut out, and they have made it so they will not index this journal. Well, we were so appalled at this, and we kept trying to get the journal indexed, and Medline kept saying no, that we decided to just take the entire archive of the Journal of Orthopaedic Medicine and put it on the Internet. And we did, and it's free. So there's about 650 papers from the Journal of Orthopaedic Medicine that you can read free of charge. You can get at them through my website, doctoryourself.com, or through several other websites. Print out these papers. Take them to your doctor. There is evidence. And the other thing to keep in mind is that there's also the simple subjective evidence of what you do. If you have less junk and have less sugar and take more vitamins, I think you're going to notice it. I think you're going to feel better.
Okay, I think we've got 10. We've got 10 minutes, and I'm going to ask you four or five questions, and you can address the ones you want to, okay?
Okay.
The role of zinc, selenium, less than chromium amino acids, the role of food cravings, what does that indicate? How does one address liver damage? In other words, what can you do to support your liver? Is there a dopamine connection in addicts? And is there a vitamin K connection in addicts?
Not sure about vitamin K, so I can't answer that with confidence.
Well, it's
dopamine...
in Dr. Hoffer's book, just so everybody knows. Look it up.
Very good. Remember, he was the expert. I wish Abram were still here to answer these questions because he was a lot smarter than I'll ever be. With dopamine, I'm pretty sure that there is a connection there. Curiously enough, these chemicals are made in our body only because of the nutrients we take. You mentioned lecithin. When people take lecithin, lecithin contains phosphatidylcholine. In the brain, that is rapidly converted into acetylcholine. And when I say rapidly, I mean after just one meal. Acetylcholine is an important neurotransmitter. Another example is serotonin or serotonin. When you consume protein foods that contain the amino acid tryptophan, the body makes more serotonin. And from tryptophan, you can also make niacin, so there's something going on there. When you take more vitamin C, you make more epinephrine, and that helps to elevate mood. This chemistry gets pretty involved, and Dr. Hoffer is the expert. My father used to say to me, when you want something, you go to the organ grinder, not the monkey. Orthomolecular medicine for everyone is probably the best source for people who really want to get into the details on this, as well as that wonderful book by Hawkins and Pauling, Orthomolecular Psychiatry. That book's hard to find, but Orthomolecular Medicine for Everyone is a paperback and it's in print. The role of minerals in these conditions has been discussed very thoroughly by medical geographer and colleague of mine, Dr. Harry Foster of the University of British Columbia. Harry, not a physician, was a medical geographer. And he would look at diseases and disease trends in the world and then take a look at their farming practices, their soil, their geology, and all the other factors that go into what they took in terms of mineral content. Harry has a website, and if you do an internet search for Harold D. as in Doug Foster, people can find that and read more about Harry's work with minerals.
And food cravings and allergies.
Food cravings. The children's doctor, Dr. Lyndon Smith, who was on TV for a long time in the United States, Dr. Smith said, if your child craves it, it's probably bad for him. I've always enjoyed that. Dr. Hoffer worked with a lot of kids that craved dairy products. They wanted milk, 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 milk. And he found that more often than not, these kids were allergic to milk. So they wanted what was bad for them. And I'm sorry that's the way sometimes it works, but it did. Another example is a young man that I worked with. He was about 14. And he really liked ham. He liked ham and bacon and cured meats that have all those additives in them, notably sodium nitrite. And he really had a craving for those. If he didn't get them, he would have meltdowns. He would have tantrums because he couldn't get his ham. And it made him worse when he had it, but he wanted it. Now, when he got off those junk foods and started having niacin, he was a completely different kid. He started getting calls and letters from the school saying how great he was doing. So these are just a couple of examples of how a craving can be taking us down the wrong road. So Dr. Smith's comment, if your child craves it, it's probably not good for him, is, I think, a good rule to go by.
Okay, we've got about 3 minutes. What about, how can one support their liver during all of this? Detox it, clean it out, because it's probably not in good shape.
Number one, read about the Gerson therapy. Dr. Max Gerson, back in the 1920s, 1930s, developed a program, a metabolic therapy that was based on detoxification of the body, particularly the liver. The liver is sort of the garbage can of the body. It's the biggest gland in the body. By weight, it may be the biggest organ. It's an enormous thing, and the liver basically detoxifies you. Now, there are other organs that help, but the liver is the one. So if you have good liver health, you can detox the body. The Gerson therapy goes into that in detail using vegetable juices, vitamin supplements, and the always controversial body temperature coffee enemas. Now, we don't have time to go into that now, but there are several excellent books on the Gerson therapy. That is the number one way to support liver function. In addition to that, the B-complex vitamins that we mentioned earlier are very valuable for people with hepatitis and cirrhosis and fatty liver. And eating right is always a good way to support the liver. Eat good, whole, unprocessed foods and try to avoid alcohol. The liver has to detox alcohol out of your body. It can process, about one drink every 2 to 2.5 hours. If you have 5 drinks, your liver is going to be awfully busy for about 12 hours. Don't do that to your liver. The best thing to do is to eat right and avoid what you know is going to hurt you.
What about alpha lipoic acid to help to support the liver? Do you know about if that helps?
I am not as well versed on that as others. I would suggest folks do an internet search on that. Patrick Halford and other folks have written extensively on that, and they're the real experts. But yes, that's a substance that should be looked at as well. But lest listeners think this is getting too complicated or too expensive, I want to come back to what Dr. Hoffer would say. No junk. You know, if you stop eating junk food, you're going to save money. Now, with the money you save, buy some niacin, some vitamin C, and a good multivitamin, and take that multivitamin breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Less sugar. With less sugar, you're going to have fewer dental bills. There, you save more money. And eat whole, unprocessed, natural foods. These are simple, broad-based, common sense, hard to argue with things that we just haven't taken far enough. Anybody can cut down sugar, anybody can cut out junk food, and anybody can eat the way Grandma told us to many years ago.
For people, let's say my daughter, who has a bad addiction problem, and we're having to use antidepressants to keep her from doing things like cutting and burning. So can we use nutritional programs along with antidepressants and then wean off? And if so, how do we know when it's that we can start weaning?
Dr. Hoffer emphasized that using nutrition along with conventional drug therapy is the most sensible and successful long-term approach. This is not an either-or type of problem. Using medication short-term for people in an emergency situation makes sense. Dr. Hoffer was a psychiatrist. He prescribed drugs. But he emphasized that drugs did not make people well. What made them well, he defined well as paying taxes. Because that means you have a job, you're independent, and you're functional.
Oh, yeah.
If to be well, you need nutrition. So it's not either or. It's use conventional therapy, especially for the short term, along with nutrients for the long term. When we do this, we have cured patients.
And when you say cure, and this is the last question because we're about out of time, what does that mean? What does cure mean?
Dr. Hoffer would say they're paying taxes. I would say they are free of the symptoms that they came in on. They are healthy, they are happy, they are enjoying life, and they're looking in their medicine cabinet and they're finding there are very few bottles there. They're looking in their kitchen sink and finding that there isn't a lot of greasy dishes piling up there. They're looking in their kitchen garbage and finding there's not a lot of junk food boxes there. And they're looking in their teeth and finding that they haven't had cavities in a while. They're looking at their mood and noticing that they're happy. And especially, they're looking in the refrigerator, noticing two cases of beer that somebody put in there and realizing they did 2 weeks ago and they never drank them.
Thank you, Dr. Saul, for this interview.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, and it's a wonderful thing to be talking about the great Dr. Hoffer. I know I sound like I'm worshiping a hero here, and that's probably not far from the truth. His knowledge based on experience is so wonderful.
He and David Hawkins are two of my heroes. In fact, I was fortunate enough to interview Abram about 2 weeks before he died.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I got that last interview, and I even said he was sick. I said, do you want to put this on? He went, no, I want to get this out there.
That's Dr. Hoffer.
He was sick when he did it. So thank you, and I hope you'll come back sometime on one of your other books.
Many thanks.
And good night. Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.